Morning. The Secondary Education and Career Development Subcommittee will now come to order. For the record, please remember to turn on your microphones for the roll call. Missy, would you call the roll, please?
Chair McLean.
Here.
Vice Chair Schoof.
Here.
Ranking Member Bush.
Here.
Representative Altman.
Here.
Representative Andrade.
Here.
Representative Benjamin. Representative Barrero.
Here.
Representative Fisher. Representative Maney.
Here.
Representative Mello. Representative Umfroy. Representative Rizzo.
Here.
Representative Robinson.
She's here.
Representative Sabatini.
Here.
Representative Tupp. Representative Valdez.
Present.
Representative Woodson.
Here.
Representative Yarborough.
Here.
Thank you, and let the record show that a quorum is present. Please remember to silence all electronic devices, be recognized by the chair before addressing the committee or the presenters, and push the microphone button after you've been recognized so that you can be heard. Members, today we'll hear two presentations from the Office of Program Policy Analysis and Government Accountability, better known as OPAGA. The first will cover transparency requirements relating to curriculum and instruction in school district budgeting and accountability. The second presentation will focus on electrocardiograms for student athletes. In an effort to get through both presentations, I will have to manage the clock, but remember that any questions we do not get to can be sent to Ms. Sanchez, and she'll follow up with a response as she has in previous meetings that we've had. So let's get to work. Mr. Clark, welcome. And you're recognized to give your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Todd Clark, and I am a senior legislative analyst for OPAGA. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present to your committee this morning on school district requirements for academic and fiscal transparency. OPAGA was directed to collect information on whether school districts provide parents and the public access to certain required fiscal and academic information. We focused on three areas. First, fiscal information, including an annual report of the school district's administrative and instructional expenditures, as well as the district's proposed, tentative, and official budgets. Second, we looked at information on how parents and the public may participate in the evaluation and selection of instructional materials, and how parents are notified of the process to request that students be exempted from the teaching of reproductive health and disease education. And third, we looked at implementation plans from the district for required health education topics, including mental and emotional health, substance abuse, and child trafficking prevention. I'd like to provide a brief overview of our methodology. To accomplish this research, OPAGA reviewed the applicable state statutes and State Board of Education rules. We then surveyed 73 school districts, the 67 county level districts, the four developmental research schools, Florida Virtual School, and the Florida School for the Deaf and the Blind, to determine if they reported meeting the transparency requirements. Independently, OPAGA reviewed all school district websites to search for a subset of the required postings. 70 of the 73 districts surveyed provided at least a partial response to OPAGA survey. 56 of the respondents fully completed the survey. OPAGA provided numerous opportunities and reminders to all school districts to reply to our request for information. First, we'll look at the fiscal transparency. OPAGA requested information from school districts on meeting two requirements related to fiscal transparency. Florida statutes require the posting of an annual accountability report that includes total revenues and expenditures that support school level and district level operations. Florida statutes also require that school districts post their proposed, tentative, and official budgets on the school district's website. We asked the school districts if they met these requirements, and if so, how they notified parents and the public. 83% of school districts who answered all the questions in this area reported meeting all of the requirements for these two fiscal transparency postings. For the annual accountability report, there were small differences in the percentages of school districts that notified parents of students in the district versus the general public. The most common method of notification was to post these reports and budgets on the school district's website. Now we'll look at instructional materials transparency. Florida statutes require the school district to maintain a list of instructional materials by grade level purchased by the school district and used in a classroom. School districts are also responsible for the content of instructional materials that are made available in the school library or included on any of the school district reading lists. The law also requires school districts to adopt and clearly describe a process for parents or the public to object to the use of specific instructional materials. Florida statutes also require that if a district school board chooses to implement its own instructional materials adoption program, it must allow the public to review recommended materials at least 20 days prior to the school board meeting to review the materials. The public must be notified of which instructional materials will be reviewed and how parents or the public may offer evidence that the recommended materials do not meet statutory criteria. Finally, Florida statutes were amended in 2021 to require that school districts notify parents of their right and the process to request their students be exempted from the teaching of reproductive health and diseases. We surveyed the school districts to ask if they met these requirements, and if so, how they notified parents and the public. 65% of the districts who answered all the questions, all the survey questions in this area, reported that the school district posted a list of materials used in classrooms, available in school libraries, and included in reading lists. Most, 94%, notified parents and the public regarding their right to review and object to instructional materials used in the classroom. The percentages were smaller for postings related to materials available in the library, about 80%, and on reading list at 70%. Common notification methods used by school districts include posting on the school district website and using newspaper notices. Most districts responding, 92%, reported that they met all the requirements to notify parents and the public regarding meeting notifications for the review and potential adoption of instructional materials. Common notification methods include the school district website, newspaper notices, and documentation for local school board meetings or workshops. As noted here, 87% of responding districts reported that they notified parents of how to request an exemption from instruction on reproductive health and disease education. Common methods included posting on the school district's website, emails to parents, and letters sent home to parents. APAGA attempted to find these links on the district's website within a period of 5 minutes. This work was done independently of the survey, and the analyst conducting the website review did not know if the school district provided a response in the survey or the location of the link that they provided in that survey. APAGA analysts were aware of the most common places where these postings would be located, and if available, we also used any search tools that were on the site if other navigational efforts were ineffective. When APAGA analysts independently tried to locate the links to instructional materials for reproductive health and disease education, and the links to notify parents of their rights to request an exemption from the teaching of reproductive health and disease education, we were only able to locate these postings on fewer than 20% of the district's websites within a 5-minute time frame. You'll notice that with these low percentages, the posting requirements were based on statute that became effective in July 1st of this year, and our survey was conducted in late August, so it may be the case that some school districts had not had time to fully implement these requirements. Now we'll look at transparency related to required instruction. Florida statutes provide a list of topics that school districts are required to provide as part of classroom instruction. This list includes a broad range of topics, including the history and content of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. State Board Administrative Rule specifically calls for 3 health education areas: mental and emotional health education, substance use and abuse health education, and child trafficking prevention education, to have implementation plans that are submitted to the Florida Department of Education and posted on the school district's website. These implementation plans usually include a list of grade level appropriate instructional materials, and for middle school and high school students, the courses where this instruction will be provided. Again, we surveyed school districts and asked if they met these requirements, and if so, how they notified the public. Most districts responding, 91%, reported that they met all the requirements to post their implementation plans for these health education topics. A slightly smaller percentage, 91%, of the districts posted their implementation plans for child trafficking prevention relative to the postings for the other two health education topics at 95%. Most districts used their school district website to post these implementation plans. Opaga was able to find the posting for these implementation plans for these three health education topics that are required to be posted for most, 63 to 70% of the school districts within the 5-minute timeframe. The Department of Education has a required instruction reporting portal that they use to collect implementation plans for all required instruction, and many school districts link to this portal as a way to share their implementation plans for these three health education topics. So at this time, what I'd like to do is I'm going to get out of the PowerPoint and provide two quick examples of websites that Opaga reviewed. We'll first look at a well-designed website with a school district where Opaga was able to locate the required postings within the 5-minute time period. So this is the St. John's County School District. And you'll notice up at the top, they've got a nice navigation bar. And under the navigation bar for families, there's a direct link over here for exemption from instructions. So again, just one click away, and you can get to the exemptions from instruction, and it provides information about how parents can get, can request from the district to be, have their students exempt from instruction on reproductive health and disease education. Again, under the same family's navigation link, there is also a resources for mental health and wellness. And if you click here under this link, with a little bit of searching, you can find there is a tile for required instruction. And when you click on this required instruction, that takes you directly to the implementation plans for the three health education topics that I mentioned. The other nice thing about the St. John's website is it has a search bar up here. And if you type in, for example, if I can type exemption, I can see where I'm typing. Okay, spelling test here. You'll notice that with that search, and clicking on enter, that the first search result is the one that is the same one that we went to through the navigation panel. So again, very easy to find stuff. Well, certainly within a 5-minute time frame, the analysts for Opaga were able to quickly get to the required postings that St. John's had on their website. So the second, in contrast, to look at the homepage for the DeSoto County School Board. So this was one where Opaga was not able to locate the links within the required time period. So in most cases, when we got to a website like this, we went to the department directory. And in most cases, the information we were looking for was under the curriculum department. So in this case, if we go to instructional services, it takes you to a place here. You can click on curriculum. You can see that this is under construction. We looked under both the resources and under the documentation. And again, looking through these different things, we were unable to find the links that we were looking for. If you come back up here under department directory again, under the student services, there was a link for mental service, mental and health counseling. And again, there's information here that relates to that, but we were unable to find the required instruction links that we were looking for. So again, in a 5-minute time period, even though we had done a fairly thorough search, we were unable to locate the links on the DeSoto County site. And you also notice there's not a search bar provided as part of this website. So unlike St. John's, we were able to go in and do the search and find exactly what we were looking for. There's no search bar included as part of this website. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you for your presentation, Mr. Clark. Members, I have a couple of questions I'd like to lead with, and then I'll get to the rest of you. And again, I'm going to have to try to manage the clock a little bit. Mr. Clark, did you all speak to any school districts or schools regarding the process they use to adopt library books?
So the questions that we asked, that I presented on, looked specifically at whether or not they had posted information about how the instructional materials adoption process occurred. And that included not only materials that are used in the classroom, but materials that are purchased for the school library. That said, we did not specifically interview or speak with any school districts about their processes that are done at the local level.
So if I hear you correctly, on the form, that question was asked?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Was there a question on there about supplemental materials?
So supplemental materials, I think what you're referring to would be things that are on reading lists. We did ask questions about things that are on reading lists. And again, most of the districts provided information that they did have information posted specifically for parents and the public to object to instructional materials, including on reading lists, that they had a problem with.
Okay. Thank you. Members, do you have any questions? Members, any questions? Representative Yarborough, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. Thank you for the presentation. Very helpful and informative. Just a quick question now, Mr. Chair, and I may have a comment after we go through the other items we need to, and out of respect for the other members who may want to ask. What you just mentioned, though, when the question was asked about what each district does, was that all self-reported, or do we have any way to verify the accuracy of that related to either what's in the libraries or the supplemental materials that you just referenced? Thank you.
You're recognized.
Yes, sir. Thank you. That's a great question. We did not specifically ask them to provide to us the local procedures that they use for those, for adopting those types of things. We were looking specifically at, did they provide information to the public or to parents about how they could object to materials that were available. But we did not interview any specific district or regarding that particular item.
Just one follow-up, Mr. So just make sure, thank you, sorry. Just make sure I understand right. So we just asked whether they were providing the notice, letting the parents opt out. It wasn't a discussion about content thus far?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Woodson, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, sir, for your presentation. My question has to do with the summary section where you, in the area of fiscal transparency, where you surveyed about 58 school districts and only 44 of them responded in that area. What happened to the 14 that did not respond? Was there any reason giving as to why they did not respond to the fiscal transparency as far as providing the information to the parents?
You recognize?
Yes, ma'am. When OPAGA put the survey out, we did provide, so we provided a link to the survey. We did not set requirements in the survey that required the district to complete every single question. We just wanted them to complete as many questions as they felt comfortable answering. If the district didn't complete any questions, we did make follow-up calls to try and encourage them to send the information in. But if they completed it, you know, any questions at all, then there wasn't any additional follow-up. So I think what you're seeing here is a reflection of the school district getting in and not completing every question in the survey.
Follow-up?
So is there any intention to do anything about those who did not respond at all? Or what would be your recommendation about those who did not respond at all?
So I think that was provided mainly for your information. We're not planning any additional follow-up.
Representative Woodson, I think that's part of why we wanted to have this. We wanted to have them take a look at what had happened, what had transpired since July 1st of 2021. And then, obviously, there's probably some things here that we as a legislature are going to have to follow up on. And certainly some of the numbers are a little dismal at best. And so not no fault of yours, just that, you know, that's what it is, and so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and if there's anything OPAGA can do to follow up, we'd be happy to do that.
Yeah. Any other questions, members?
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. Mr. Clark, thank you for doing that, and again, I apologize you had to sit through our last meeting and didn't get to present, but thank you for being here this morning, and we appreciate the information that you all gathered on that. Members, now we'll move on to our second presentation, and this will be on EKGs, and Ms. Harvey, you're welcome, and you're recognized to make your presentation.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the entire committee for giving me the opportunity to present our research on electrocardiograms for high school student athletes. My name is Kirsten Harvey. I am a senior policy analyst with the Office of Program Policy Analysis and Government Accountability. OPAGA was instructed to gather information on the benefits and challenges.
Ms. Harvey, could you adjust your microphone a little bit, or you're going to have to use your outside voice?
Oh, no. Okay.
Thank you.
I'll speak up. Please let me know if it's still an issue.
I think that's pretty good there. Thank you.
Okay. OPAGA was instructed to gather information on benefits and challenges associated with requiring EKG assessments for student athletes, the costs of EKG assessments, the accuracy of EKG assessments, current Florida school district practices regarding the use of EKG assessments, and to identify any nationally recognized or accepted criteria that help determine which athletes should receive an EKG assessment. We obtained this information in a variety of ways. We conducted interviews. We spoke with major medical organizations, physicians, and other stakeholders. In addition, we conducted a literature review. For this portion, we relied heavily on position statements from major medical organizations as they synthesized various scientific information. And we administered a survey to Florida's 67 county-based school districts to learn about current practices. First, I'll provide some background information on sudden cardiac death, electrocardiogram assessments, and why the two are connected. Sudden cardiac death is when the heart stops suddenly. And this is rare. You can see the number on the screen. 1 in 23,000 to 1 in 300,000 high school athletes will suffer from this. However, it is also the leading cause of non-traumatic death among young athletes. Sudden cardiac death can be triggered by intense physical activity. Often, an athlete will have no prior indication that there is a problem with their heart. And over the course of our research, we identified one diagnosis in particular that is associated with sudden cardiac death, and that is hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, HCM. In addition, I have in the table on the screen some other conditions, as well as their prevalence in the general population. And these are conditions that may lead to sudden cardiac death. Electrocardiogram assessments, or EKG assessments, may help identify up to 60% of the conditions that can cause sudden cardiac death. EKGs do this by recording the heart's strength, speed, rhythm, and number of beats at a moment in time. It is a quick, non-invasive procedure. And on the right of the slide, we provide some related diagnoses. Now, to be clear, an EKG assessment on its own will not necessarily diagnose some of these conditions, but it will present a red flag that would lead to follow-up and eventual diagnosis. Now I'll discuss current health requirements for student athletes in Florida and EKG-related requirements in other states. The Florida High School Athletic Association, or the FHSAA, is the governing body for interscholastic athletics in Florida for students in grades 6 through 12. The FHSAA requires that students satisfactorily pass a medical evaluation on an annual basis. This evaluation must be conducted by a qualified medical professional. In addition, the evaluation must incorporate American Heart Association cardiovascular screening recommendations and advise students to undergo a cardiovascular assessment. The medical evaluation form, which is called the pre-participation physical evaluation form, and the results of any cardiovascular assessment are held on file at the school. As mentioned, the medical evaluation is conducted using a pre-participation physical evaluation form. This form collects information that's basic student information, such as address and name, as well as student medical information, and the results of a physical evaluation. At the end of this process, a physician may choose to clear a student to play all sports. The physician may choose that a student is not cleared for certain sports, or the physician may determine that a student can be cleared after further evaluation or rehabilitation. In addition to the pre-participation physical evaluation form, parents and students sign a consent and release from liability form, and this form does include information on sudden cardiac arrest. The pre-participation physical evaluation form advises students to undergo a cardiovascular assessment, which may include an EKG assessment. And we put that language on the screen there next to the heart. In addition, the pre-participation physical evaluation form asks 41 questions of all students. Several of these questions may help identify students who are at risk of sudden cardiac death. These include questions about chest pain, dizziness, and family history. The Florida High School Athletic Association's questions on the pre-participation physical evaluation form generally align with American Heart Association recommendations. The current FHSAA pre-participation physical evaluation form includes 7 of the 10 questions recommended by the American Heart Association. Two states, Texas and Pennsylvania, have recently passed EKG assessment legislation. Neither state requires EKG assessments for student athletes. While Florida focuses on cardiovascular health broadly, Texas and Pennsylvania focus on EKG assessment education specifically. For example, Texas requires school districts to provide information about EKG assessments to students and parents, and Pennsylvania requires that information is provided, as well as coaches undergo training. And we'll talk a little bit more about Pennsylvania on the next slide. In Pennsylvania, in addition to educating students and training coaches, if a student exhibits any of the symptoms listed on the left side of the slide, the student must obtain physician clearance before returning to play. Now, the physician may choose or not choose to administer an EKG assessment in order to provide that clearance. In order to learn about how EKG assessments may or may not be used currently in Florida school districts, we administered a survey to Florida's 67 county-based school districts. 41 districts, the counties in gray, neither require nor recommend EKG assessments for student athletes. 6, the counties in lighter blue, recommend EKG assessments for student athletes. And 6, the counties in darker blue require EKG assessments for student athletes. 14 districts did not respond to the survey. Also, although 6 districts reported that they require EKG assessments, only 5 of those districts responded to subsequent questions, so you'll see a discrepancy in the numbers on the following slides. All districts that require or recommend EKG assessments apply this policy to students in high school, and 7 districts also apply this policy to students in middle school. In addition, all districts apply this policy to FHSAA-governed sports. We have a list of those on the screen. We asked about why districts chose to require or recommend EKG assessments. Most districts mentioned a general awareness of cardiac issues as the reason why they chose to recommend or require EKG assessments. However, a few districts also noted that a student either in their district or a student in another district suffered a cardiac event. Out of the 41 districts that neither recommend nor require EKG assessments, 9 provided reasons. These reasons include issues with equal access for students, feasibility, and cost. For districts that require EKG assessments, 2 districts, Suwannee and Brevard, reported that they allow parents to opt out of this requirement. 3 districts, Indian River, Osceola, and Orange, do not have an opt-out option for parents. And of the 11 districts that require or recommend EKG assessments, 9 require that a student obtain physician clearance if they receive an abnormal EKG assessment result. We spoke with Brevard County School District to learn a bit more about their approach. In this district, parents can opt out of the EKG assessment for any reason. In 2020-21, 35% of parents opted out. This is compared to 9% who opted out in the prior year. We obtained data related to students in Brevard who received an EKG assessment in school year 2019-20. The large blue circle represents the 5,877 students who received an EKG assessment. The green circle represents 3.4%, or the 199 students, who received an abnormal result on their EKG assessment and were recommended for further follow-up. And the red circle represents the 0.1%, or 8 students, who received an abnormal EKG assessment result and later reported a diagnosis that did put them at risk for sudden cardiac arrest. In all districts, the family will typically cover the cost of the EKG assessment. However, in some districts, they receive assistance. Suwannee, which is that lone number one school district at the bottom of the bar graph, reported that they may cover the cost of a discounted EKG assessment for a student if the student's family cannot cover that cost. We also asked about how students receive their EKG assessment in these districts. 8 reported that students receive this from their own family physician. 8 reported that they work with an external organization to provide EKG assessments to students. And 8 reported that students may receive their EKG assessment during a school-held physical night. Some districts in Florida do partner with external organizations to make EKG assessments more accessible to students. One frequently mentioned nonprofit in Florida is Who We Play For. This organization has medical personnel administer the EKG assessment, and then volunteer cardiologists interpret that EKG assessment. Students who receive abnormal results are contacted and advised to seek follow-up. And this organization also works with the other nonprofits listed on the screen. We examined potential challenges with requiring EKG assessments for student athletes. Of the districts that require or recommend EKG assessments for student athletes, 5 reported challenges. These include the cost of administering and interpreting the EKG assessment, identifying qualified medical professionals, and cost of follow-up care. And we examined cost data of EKG assessments as well as common follow-up procedures. Here we provide the average cost across Florida and the minimum and maximum across Florida. The cost of the EKG assessment, that first row, includes the cost of administering the EKG assessment as well as the cost of interpreting the EKG assessment. in 8 school districts. Who We Play For is able to cover some of the cost, and students can receive an EKG assessment for $20. We did hear in the course of our research that insurance companies may not cover the cost of EKG assessments for asymptomatic individuals. For children under Children's Health Insurance Program and Medicaid public insurance, an EKG assessment is only covered if ordered by a physician. So officials at the Agency for Healthcare Administration and the Department of Health let us know that there would likely need to be statutory changes in order for an EKG assessment to be covered for these students. And the map below provides estimates of children on CHIP and Medicaid by county. In total, over 1 million children are on CHIP or Medicaid in Florida. We gathered information on the medical community's perspective on this issue, and we found that no major medical organization in the United States supports universal EKG assessments for student athletes. However, the European Society of Cardiology and the International Olympics Committee are in support of EKG assessments for student athletes. There are a variety of reasons for the lack of support by U.S. medical organizations. The reasons provided include those related to scientific issues, such as the lack of scientific consensus supporting testing of asymptomatic individuals. In addition, the organizations mention a variety of implementation issues, and these include inequitable access to healthcare, availability of pediatric cardiologists for follow-up care, and potential liability for false negative results. We gathered information related to false positive and false negative EKG assessment results. False positive results refer to identifying a problem when there is no underlying issue. And for EKG assessments, this ranges from about 1.3% to 5%. So we wanted to put this in real numbers for you. We requested an estimate of student athletes from the school districts we surveyed. And based on those responses, we estimate that between 2,716 and 10,444 may receive false positive results from an EKG assessment. Now, this is based on estimates only from 44 Florida school districts, so this is an underestimate. False negative results refer to missing a problem when there is an underlying issue. And these can range between 10% for hypertrophic cardiomyopathy or HCM to 90% for congenital coronary anomalies. And congenital coronary anomalies refer to a broad range of heart issues that someone is born with that cause the heart to not work as effectively. This concludes our research on EKG assessments for student athletes. I am happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Harvey, thank you for that presentation and the thoroughness of it. Members, do you have any questions? Representative Valdez, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so very much for your presentation today. This is very enlightening information. On page 17, where you talked about the district opt-out to return to play, for those families that decided to opt out of obtaining the EKG, and God forbid, knock on wood, something were to happen on the field or during practice or whatever, what does that opt-out do for that family or not do for that family? If something happens to the child while on the practice field or on the game and they opted out on having, I guess, who'd be liable, if you will, how does this opt-out process protect either the child or the family or even the school district, for that matter, mm-hmm. as taxpayer dollars?
You're recognized.
Thank you. I believe that for those parents who chose to opt out, they do sign a liability waiver, but I will check on that and get back with you.
Representative Rizzo, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for the presentation. Thank you very much for the presentation. I have a couple of questions, Chair, if I may.
Sure.
On slide 29, it says, based on an estimate of 208,000, just over 208,000 total student athletes, is that the number of athletes that had physicals done, or is that the number of student athletes that had EKGs done?
You recognize?
Thank you. That is the total number of student athletes who participate under the FHSAA, based on estimates from 44 school districts. So those subsequent numbers, the 2,716 and the 10,444, is the estimate for students with false positive results. In this scenario, we are imagining that all 208,000 students did receive an EKG assessment.
So that 208, through the chair, so that 208,000, 209,000 is the total number of students within the FHSAA yearly physicals. And I guess what I'm trying to get at is, you know, so that's an extrapolation, that 2,700 to 10,004, that's an extrapolation. If it were given, if EKGs were given to each one of those roughly 209,000 students, that's what we would have as false positives, correct?
You recognize?
Correct, yes.
Okay, and Chair, another question, if I may? Thank you.
You recognize?
Do we know how many deaths or emergencies from sudden cardiac emergencies arise on a yearly basis in Florida with our athletes?
You recognize?
Thank you. We did not find that information available in a central repository or in a database, so we do not have that information.
Okay, and my last question, Chair.
You recognize?
Thank you. And it kind of pertains to Rep. Valdez's question. Those parents that opted out, is there any sort of data or information as to perhaps why they opted out of the EKG screenings where they were offered?
You recognize?
Thank you. No, the school district did not tell us about any rationale for opting out. One district did mention that some parents do not like the idea of a mandate, and that could be related, but we don't have the information specifically for parents who opted out.
Thank you very much, Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Umphrey, you're recognized.
Thank you so very much, Chair. Is it possible that the parents' concerns were cost? How much do these tests cost?
You recognize?
Thank you. Up on the screen is our cost slide. Again, we do not know what the parents' rationale was for opting out for those parents who did choose to opt out. The cost of an EKG assessment is up on the screen. It's on average $84. It can range from $74 to $102. However, as mentioned, Who We Play For has worked with 8 Florida school districts to provide EKG assessments for $20.
Representative Woodson, then I'll come back to you. Representative Woodson, you're recognized for a question. Yes, ma'am.
I have a few questions as well.
Okay.
Thank you so much for your presentation. We learned a lot from it, actually. My question has to do with slide 29, where in the category of false positive result, we are looking at the range between the computer readings and the human readings, and it appears, based on the information that you provided, that the computer readings is greater than the, when it comes to false positive. And the false negative, which is the most alarming and concerning to me, is there also, do you have the range for that as to which one is higher when it comes to the computer readings as opposed to the human readings?
You recognize?
Thank you. We did not find that information. We just found false negative rates based on certain diagnoses. Unfortunately, those were not broken up by computer readings versus human readings.
That would be good to know, because the false negative is even more alarming, because that's the one when there's a problem and it's not detected. So I would like to see that if it's possible. I have another question.
You're recognized for
okay. My second question has to do with who we play for. Are they here? I see that they provide EKG assessment for $20 per student. Is that including the reading? And I want to know also, are they also contracted? They are contracted with 8 school districts. Is Broward County and Miami-Dade County part of those two that you are contracted with?
You're recognized.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Representative Woodson, there's no one that signed up to speak from who we play for, but we could try to follow up on that question for you on that portion of it, and then if you want to try to answer the other portion, that'd be great. Thank you. I thought there was another piece to that, Representative Woodson. You want to restate?
I think she was about to answer, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry.
The first part of the question, right?
Restate your first part.
First part has to do, who we play for provide the EKG assessment for $20 per student. Is that including the reading?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Yes, that includes administration and interpretation. And the reason they are able to do that, based on what we heard, is they have volunteer cardiologists interpreting the EKG assessment. That is the more expensive part of an EKG assessment, is getting that interpretation. The administration is a less expensive part of the EKG assessment.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Valdez for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I address our presenter today, when we were in committee last session that we voted on this particular bill, was the organization that spoke to us about providing these EKGs, was it the same organization that we're referencing today? Do you remember, Mr. Chair?
So who we play for has probably been the most prominent organization to offer EKGs to student athletes, and it's 8 counties that they're currently operating in under an agreement with each individual county. So they probably would have been referenced in material that we had last session.
Okay. All right. I was wondering how many other organizations provide that service, but that's offline. We could talk about that offline.
Okay. Thank you, Representative.
But thank you, sir. But my question to you is, based on, and I don't know if you know this answer or not, and I just question, because I know when I go get my physical done, an EKG, blood work, things of that nature is all inclusive. I'm not sure if that is a criteria for the physicals for students or children that are on Medicaid. Do you know if that is a requirement or if it's just a visit to your pediatrician? I believe they were called EPSDTs before, way back in the day, where you had those periodic physicals. Do you know if by any chance that's a criteria for Medicaid recipients to, and I'm talking about children, to receive that as part of their physical?
You recognize?
Thank you. Our focus for CHIP and Medicaid was very narrow. It was essentially, if this were required of all student athletes, would students on CHIP and Medicaid have that covered without a physician referring them to undergo an EKG assessment? So I can't speak to what physicals look like typically for those students, but this would not be covered currently.
Thank you.
Members, any other questions? Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I may have a few questions.
Okay. Yes, sir. Yeah.
So these cardiovascular problems, these heart problems have hit our community pretty hard. I know of quite a few incidents of deaths. And really appreciate you doing this report. Mr. Chairman, I want to really commend you for hearing it, because it's a significant problem. I do have questions about your report, though. And first one is on page 4. Instance of sudden cardiac death among high school athletes ranges from 1 in 23,000 to 1 in 100,000. How do you justify that spread? I mean, the science of that, that's incredible. That's an incredible difference. Why is it? Why is there such a disparity there?
You're recognized.
Thank you. These numbers were taken from the American Heart Association statement. There are certain areas of the world, Veneto, Italy specifically, where students may be more likely to experience sudden cardiac death. That could explain for the range. Also, we did hear there isn't a central repository for sudden cardiac death. There may be a lack of data on this specifically.
Yeah, I assume there's something missing there because that doesn't seem to be a very accurate depiction with that spread, but that it would be helpful if we knew what it would be like in Florida. And I don't know, I'm not a doctor, but you might surmise that some of the differences, for example, might be environmental, like heat. We've seen a lot of deaths on the football field in Florida at the beginning of the season when they're out there training in 94 to 95 degree heat, almost 100% humidity. So it would be interesting to see where we rank up, and maybe something like that. If you looked at global, maybe weather or something, diet, I don't know, genetics. But I think that shows that this report may not be as accurate as we would hope, because that kind of spread doesn't give us a good picture. The second, it deals with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, something that I know a little bit about because it's hit our friends, our close community very closely, where we've known children that have cardiomyopathy, and adults that have a heart, you know, a hole in their heart that they may not find out until 60s or 70s. And under your report, it's 1 in 500 in the general population. That's staggering. Even in an athletic range, 1 in 1,400, 1 in 1,600. That is an incredible high incidence. And I know a lot of these deaths come from cardiomyopathy. I use an analogy. If you were going to put your teenager in a car and you knew they had a 1 in 500 chance or even 1 in 1,400 chance that they were going to either die or have a serious injury, that's a frightening statistic. And I, when I read the whole report, I felt as though it sort of downplayed the significance and need for this testing. But when you put it, tie that with your own data of 1 in 500 chance, that shows us a significant problem that we have. Did y'all consider that when you did the total report?
You recognize.
We used peer-reviewed studies to find these figures and report on them. HCM, as I mentioned, is the leading cause of sudden cardiac death. It is responsible for about 1/3 of sudden cardiac death cases. We simply reported figures without, you know, considering if it leaned one way or another.
I felt that's a staggering number, and that shows a significant problem. And I appreciate you pointing that out in your report. Another question I have is the cost of the EKGs. I'm curious how you derive the cost of that. Did you just talk to a doctor's office or what they typically charge in an office? Or did you get prices, for example, if you had a physician or a physician assistant or nurse practitioner team do these EKGs at a rate of maybe 200 at a time? So they're kind of mass producing them. Because if the cost came from an average doctor, that's going to be higher. Did you consider the mass production, mass testing of these and as a potential way of mitigating those costs?
You recognize.
Thank you. We just got numbers on cost in general. We received that information from the Agency for Healthcare Administration's Price Finder, which used 70.3 million claims from a set of insurers and negotiated provider rates. So that's where those figures come from.
I think it would be interesting if we looked at the figures in terms if you had the high school football team and the girls and boys basketball team and soccer teams and track teams, you got them in on a day and you tested them all at once. I would have to think there would be tremendous economies of scale that we could significantly cut those costs. And I've attended some of the who we play for EKG screening events, and I don't think that's necessarily an accurate number, and I'd like to see if you can you go back and refine those some more. And then one more question, Mr. Chairman. You know, cardiomyopathy or sudden deaths from a lot of these heart problems, they don't just occur in high school. We've read a lot about collegiate athletes and even professional athletes that have fell victim to these. So when we do testing, whether it's middle school, high school, we are, and I do have one more after this, I was wrong. We know that's a long-term thing, and I don't know, did you evaluate in terms of the number of deaths? I know you did say there's not a lot of accurate, but through the course of a lifetime, because when you do this test and you do detect cardio problems, heart problems, it's a lifetime death that you might prevent. That could increase the number of deaths that you could be preventing. Did you do any longitudinal work and trying to get those numbers?
You recognize.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, you looked at deaths from athletes, but is that, did you look at collegiate athletes and professional athletes?
You recognize.
We had a narrow focus on high school student athletes.
So when you do a test and you find a problem, I mean, the deaths would be greater if you looked at a longer period of time, or even if you looked at those high school athletes that might have caught their cardiomyopathy in high school, might have prevented a death when they're in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. So I think that would also give us a better number in terms of the impact of this. And finally, when you looked at the issue of liability, did you take in consideration that our public schools have sovereign immunity, our universities have sovereign immunity, that they're protected from lawsuits? And did you look at any statutes that we provided, providing certain health care providers, such as teaching hospitals, sovereign immunity? And we also have Good Samaritan laws that also give sovereign immunity. Did you consider, or I didn't see those in the report, as a way of mitigating the liability exposure?
You recognize.
Thank you. In regards to the liability for false negative assessments, that was a concern brought up in the American Heart Association's position statement. And in that position statement, the concern for false negative liability was actually a concern for the physician, not for the school. And so we were just reporting on concerns mentioned by major medical organizations.
So the sovereign immunity thing. Okay, thank you. I really appreciate your report. I appreciate you being here. And this is a serious problem, so thank you.
Ms. Harvey, I have a couple of questions. When you spoke with who we play for, did they communicate whether they have the capacity to serve the entire state of Florida? Was that any part of the conversation? If we were to require EKG assessments, and you're recognized,
we did ask them that question. They reported that they felt they could serve all Florida school districts in about 3 to 5 years with some additional funding assistance. Something we heard again and again about implementing a policy like this is that rollout and slow rollout is key to success. So that is what we heard from who we play for.
Okay, thank you. Also, so who's the final repository for the medical, for the physical? I mean, did you ask that question? I mean, like, is the school district, do they keep that, or does it go to FHSAA? Who's the final repository of any of this paperwork, either the opt-in, opt-out, you know, the actual physical itself?
Students may not opt out of the physical evaluation for the FHSAA. That is held by school districts. In terms of the opt-out for the EKG assessment, I'm not sure where that's held. I would imagine the school.
Okay, so normally then the regular physical paperwork would be held by the school district. Thank you. Also, I noticed on the medical organizational support slide, most of the major organizations didn't support universal EKGs. Were there other things that they would recommend to prevent sudden cardiac deaths?
These organizations do support a physical assessment. They also recommend having automatic external defibrillators or AEDs on site in order to respond quickly to a sudden cardiac arrest and prevent that from becoming a sudden cardiac death. And indeed, Florida currently does require that AEDs are available during games and practices and that coaches are trained to use those AEDs.
Thank you for that. Members, does anyone else have a question? If not, we have about 5 or 6 people that are signed up that would like to speak, and so I'd like to move on to that. All right, very good. Ladies and gentlemen, I will call your name. You need to come up to the dais here. We've got about 25 minutes left, so I'm going to ask you to keep your comments to about 3 to 4 minutes, so that we can make sure that we get through all of you, and then also that we can, if there's any final comments by members of the committee, they can make those, and then we can be done on time. So our first speaker this morning is Bob Harris, Panhandle Area Educational Consortium. Good morning, Mr. Harris. You're recognized.
Mr. Chairman, good morning. Committee members, good morning. As you said, my name is Bob Harris, and I have the honor and privilege of representing over the past 20 years the Panhandle Area Educational Consortium, which, of course, as Representative Schoaf knows, all the small rural school districts west of here. I have just a couple points I want to make in the time we have allotted, but I want to say, first of all, thank you to OPAGA for doing an incredible job with this. I've been involved with this for 3 years when one of our school districts signed a contract with who we play for. And after that contract was signed, as the lawyer, general counsel for PAC, they came to me and asked me what I thought after they signed the contract. And so I gave them my thoughts about it. So I want to say 3 things very quickly. First of all, the superintendents of the Panhandle Consortium all care about their students more than you can possibly imagine, as all 67 school districts do. So please understand that my remarks are not a reflection of that. They care, as you know, with small school districts, they're closer to their families than probably most superintendents are. And so please, my remarks are not intended in any way to take away from that. They care greatly, I can tell you that, because I talk to them every day. We oppose this for 2 reasons, and specifically, there was a bill pending, House Bill 59. First, as has been mentioned, is the cost. The cost is in that approximate range. Our range that we've determined is anywhere from $75 to about $250 a pop. And the bill that is out there does not say who will have to pay for that. So it means it's going to have to fall upon the parents or fall upon the school districts to pay. Now, I did meet with 2 years ago, sit down for several hours with the Who We Play For people. And all I can say is this. I have several causes in my life. The cause for Who We Play For is unbelievable. And I hold them in high regard for this, why they're doing what they do. But we sat down with them, and they explained to us why they could do this for $20 a pop. And that's what the contract with our school district had. The problem is, of course, is when Who We Play For goes away, or those bank of volunteer cardiologists goes away, that statute's going to stay there. And that means that obligation, the cost, is going to fall back on the parents, or it's going to fall back on the school districts. And again, as Representative Schoaf knows, our small and rural school districts just do not have the money to continue to pay for those kinds of things. There is another thing, the Who We Play For contract, and Representative, you asked about that, it has a provision there, has 2 things that cause me great concern. It says that we have to waive and release them and indemnify them, and the contract that I have from them does not limit it to sovereign immunity limits. Not only can we not legally do that as a school district, but that's what's in there. There's no limit to sovereign immunity limits. The second thing we have to do as a school district under their contract that I have from them is we have to go out and get releases from the individual students and parents, and they have to indemnify and release Who We Play For. So I met with them. I talked to them for hours last year. If they get past those issues, I'll be glad to talk to them, but right now we still have those issues. There are also follow-up costs. Once that first abnormality is detected, there are significant costs for those parents that may or may not have health insurance. And how are they going to pay for that? When Johnny or Mary is told there's an abnormality, how are they going to pay for that? And how is the school district going to pay for that? Here's the second reason why, and this is probably the more significant thing. The bill that's being considered and this whole issue, no one has determined who will be responsible for making the decision on whether Johnny or Mary can return to play. Let me show you this. After being approached in 2018, I did a considerable amount of research. Every year, there's a thing called the Bethesda Conference that's held United States, where all the cardiologists meet with the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology. And they get together, and they have, for the past 40 years, issued reports about the specific issue. When should or should not competitive athletes compete if there's an abnormality in their heart? What they have done in 2005, and this is the latest version, 2015, they are 15 separate task force reports analyzing everything from condition, as Representative Altman mentioned, to level of play, middle school, high school, college, now with more adults playing, the conditions under which they play, what type of abnormality it might be. There are literally hundreds of things. And I can tell you this. When I get calls from our superintendents and principals every day about what to do, I cannot advise them what to do since this bill is silent about whose responsibility it is to make a decision. We're not qualified to do that. And I can tell you, we don't have a lot of cardiologists between here and Walton County, but even they are probably not qualified to make that decision. So again, I want to commend Who We Play For people and Representative Hawkins and others who push this issue, because I'm a father of two adult children who played sports all the way through high school and college. Anything we could do to protect our students is great, but this is not the path we all should follow. Mr. Chairman, I do have, by the way, some answers specifically for the questions members asked. I'd be glad to do that, or just at some point in time come back and...
I think what would be best, Mr. Harris, would be maybe for you to follow up with those individual members. I feel like there will probably be some follow-up anyway, so, but thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for your comments this morning. Yes, sir. Martha Lopez Anderson.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity. I'm speaking in favor of House Bill 59, and I come before you as the executive director of Parent Heart Watch, the only national organization that is solely dedicated to the preventing sudden cardiac arrest and sudden cardiac death in the young. I also come before you as the mother of a sudden cardiac death victim. My seemingly healthy son, Sean, never missed a day of school, never missed a well checkup. And just like that, he collapsed on the sidewalk while rollerblading. 30 days prior, he had had a well child checkup. Everything was great, yet Sean died. 4.5 months later, I learned that Sean had an undetected heart condition. He had a well-child checkup that was consisted of history and physical, and it failed him. So after I found out that he had an undetected heart condition, I also learned that a very simple, non-invasive, painless test could have saved his life. That was like losing him all over again. And so here I am, again, as a executive director, but as a parent as well. You know how long ago this happened? 18 years ago. 18 years ago. And we're still debating what we should do to protect our kids. There's something wrong with this picture. We should not be debating. We should be coming up with solutions, right? And I applaud Representative Hawkins and Who We Play For, and all the organizations in our state that are really working together to make a difference, to affect change. So, sadly, it wasn't just Sean. Every single day, as part of my job, I talk to newly affected families from the state of Florida and from around our country. And why? Because, again, the standard of care is failing them. And that standard of care consists of history and physical alone. So, how many kids are affected? 1 in 300 is at risk for sudden cardiac arrest. It's the leading cause of death in student athletes and in our school campuses. It's not so rare. In 2020, a study said over 23,000 kids suffer out-of-hospital cardiac arrest annually in our country. This does not cover outside of our country. And I want to thank OPAGA for their report, but I would like to raise some major points that need to be clarified. 60% ECG efficacy is incredibly misleading. It is actually 80 to 90% effective on HCM, long QT, WPW, and many other conditions. Those can be saved. So do we just throw those kids away because we can't find coronary anomalies? Secondly, the fact that U.S. and medical and scientific organizations don't support ECG screening for lack of evidence is really disingenuous, as they support history and physical with no evidence. I'm going to repeat that again, no evidence. I will ask any physician, anybody, to bring forth any literature, any article that says that history and physical alone is effective in identifying youth at risk for sudden cardiac arrest and death.
Ms. Anderson,
you will not find
it. Ms. Anderson, if you could wrap up your remarks for me, please.
So the cost estimates are incorrect, as you put no onus on insurance companies who should cover the screening. It will cost them less than supporting a brain-damaged child for the rest of their life, or are we simply counting on the child dying? Kids should not die during or after playing the sport they love. With your help and leadership, we can prevent needless deaths with pre-participation physical evaluations that include electrocardiogram screening. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And we're sorry for your loss. Sean Seema. You're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you for having us, and thank you for giving us a chance to speak on this. Like Martha, I am the father of a sudden cardiac arrest victim, a 16-year-old fabulous athlete who was in the picture of health and who one night went to the gym to go run on a treadmill to get ready for cheerleading, and my daughter dropped dead. Thankfully, there was people in the gym that night that knew CPR, and they saved her life, and she has a defibrillator in her chest. They life-flighted my daughter to Orlando. My wife and I stood hand in hand, and we made a promise to God that we wouldn't let this happen again. I'm a retired Air Force officer. I've been seeing patients for 23 years. I've done thousands of these physicals, and until my daughter almost died, 1 in 300, I stamped and signed my name, and I didn't clear those kids. I thank you. I thank you for this study. But like Martha, I too disagree, because my life's mission is this now. Somebody asked, do we have any numbers for Florida in the last 5 years? This is just 5 years. I have, and I found them on news articles, because there's no great way to track these. If I put all of the ones I found on here, the only space open would be about the size of Lake Okeechobee. This happens a lot. This happens a lot, and we're missing it. When this happened to me, I happened to meet Jennifer Sullivan a couple years ago. She was our last committee chairman for education. And you brought up having AEDs and having coaches CPR trained. You guys didn't know anything about that until I happened to have the opportunity to screen Jennifer Sullivan's cousin, who had a heart condition. And I met up with her, and I brought this to her attention. It's part of the Zach Martin Act, which was the heat stroke law that y'all voted on a couple years ago. And because of that law, now instead of having an AED just at a playoff game, no matter where our kids are training or playing, whether it be practice or a game, there's an AED within arm's reach, and there's a coach that knows CPR. And already that law has saved lives. Earlier this year, I stood up here and we talked about a CPR requirement that has been fought for 10 years and was told no. My daughter and I marched around here for 4 years. And finally, we got up in front of many of you And Representative Benjamin, I believe you said, if we can save one life, we've saved the world. Mission accomplished. I hate to point at you, sir, but Mr. Mania, in your town, at Crestview High School, where I was stationed in the United States Air Force, the first week of school in September, there was a kid at Crestview High School who learned CPR and walked in the bathroom and found a dead kid on the ground and did CPR and saved his life. That's what you all voted on. And I am bringing this to your attention. There's a lot of data out there that says we shouldn't do this and money. How can we talk about money and how are we gonna do stuff and liability? What liability do you have if Sean Sima stamps and signs and says, you're clear to go play sports? How is the school liable for that? The studies are out there. And I know I'm running out of time because I'm long-winded. I work with who we play for. It's my life's mission. We are in 10 counties. Many of you sitting up there, I Facebook slam you with stories. And if you think sudden cardiac arrest is rare, go talk in the lunchroom. So Orange County just made this required to screen a kid with an EKG 1 May. And I just updated this on Monday. 22 kids, many of them who've had surgery, 2 who have defibrillators. Our county, little Podunk, Brevard County, many of these kids are walking around and we're clearing them. And
Sean, I have some other folks.
Okay, I'm going.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. No matter what happens, give us the opportunity to sit down face to face with you and show you the standard of care has to change. Many of the people. All right, this is my last thing. But many of the people that were on those committees that said, we don't recommend this, 2 of them. We did a...
Sean, I have 3 other...
All right, I'll go.
Okay, thank you. Representative...
But 2 of them were on the American...
Hey, Sean, Representative Fisher has a question he wants to ask you, but y'all are going to have to do that offline because if I have enough time, I'll let you ask the question. But I have 3 other people that have driven quite a ways to speak. Taylor or Stewart? And Ms. Stewart, unfortunately, I'm going to have to cut you off at about 3 minutes.
Good morning. My name is Taylor Stewart, and I'm from Orange County, and I'm a sophomore in high school. I'm a student athlete, and I've been cheerleading since I was 5 years old. I've done volleyball, flag football, so you can imagine I've received my well-round of physicals my whole life, and I've continued to pass them. Nothing wrong. I was a healthy girl, and when high school came and we started requiring EKGs, I got mine done and it came back as abnormal. And I had no idea that I had symptoms until I went to the doctor and they mentioned what these symptoms were. Then I realized that I had them. It was normal for me. I was born like this. Why would I be aware that there were symptoms? So I'm very grateful that I was able to, after the EKG, go and get a checkup and realize that I did have symptoms this whole time. The sad part was that I was not cleared. I had Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome, and that came up through my EKG. I would have had no idea. And I was able to meet with a cardiologist, and I had to undergo an ablation to be able to even continue my sports that I've been doing my whole life. They said that it was a miracle that I hadn't had cardiac arrest already, and that if we didn't solve this problem, it could happen very near in the future, even if I didn't do my sports. During the procedure, I actually did go into cardiac arrest. They thought they were done, and they took all the catheters out, and I actually went into cardiac arrest, and they had to go back in. So what could you imagine if I was on the volleyball court or the football field and I just dropped dead? I would have had no idea. And yeah, they might have had people around to help me, but that doesn't guarantee. If we had no EKGs, I would never have undergone surgery and would have been playing my sports this year, but at what cost? Today, I am cleared for all of my sports, and it is thanks to the EKGs being required in Orange County, and I'm very grateful. I highly encourage these EKGs being encouraged in all of Florida, because knowing how it saved my life, I would want to do just the same for all other student athletes. There might be a cost, there might be false negatives or some frustration, but isn't my life worth it to you? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stewart. Tiffany Stewart? You're recognized.
Good morning. My name is Tiffany Stewart, and I am Taylor's mother. And I just wanted to come here and give you a mom or parent's perspective of, you know, what's happened to us this year. It's very fresh. It's very raw. Essentially, our world was turned upside down on June 1st of this year. I had a 15-year-old, perfectly healthy child who has cheered since she was 4 years old, who has had her wellness visit, who's had a sports physical since she was four, and actually had her sports physical the day before she had her ECG and passed it. Told she was perfectly healthy. Our doctor even told us that she thought the ECG was a joke. Like, why bother? So me as a parent who, now it's one more step, now I gotta pay this $20. I'm so mad at myself because the night of June 1st when I received the phone call that said, hey, your ECG came back abnormal, I was in shock. I was like, this can't be right. She's fine. She's upstairs sleeping. And then we took her to the doctor and it was confirmed. And then she had, you know, the surgery. And as she described, she went into cardiac arrest. I mean, her doctor came out to me and her father 6.5 hours later when I couldn't see my daughter yet and literally told us that she was going to die on the operating table, that they had to go back in, that they were thankfully able to save her life. I know that there's a cost. I recognize that this can be frustrating. Like I said, I was one of those parents, and I'm actually disgusted with myself that I was. But I'm here to tell you that if it could save one life, it saved my daughter's. We know other people in our community that it has saved their lives. And so my answer to this is, for requiring a $20 physical that didn't at all help my daughter, why would we not want to do the preventative maintenance? These are conditions that are could prevent, if we're fixing them, prevent sudden cardiac arrest. Why would we not want to check that out? So, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Stewart, for your testimony. Evan Ernst.
Thank you. Oh, man. So this is a pretty heavy day for us in our Who We Play For team, but I don't want to ever to go unsaid how honored we are to be here to talk to you about this story. There's not a chance on God's green earth we can answer all the questions that have come up today, but I'm happy to give it a go in about 2 minutes. And anybody who doesn't believe in this, we welcome you to the table with open arms because you make this better. It's all love. We appreciate it deeply. On this day 14 years ago, I showed up to a high school soccer field December 1st in a small town with a group of my lifelong best friends. And I watched my little brother's best friend collapse and die in the arms of our teammates from hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, a condition that's detectable 95% of the time with an ECG. When Rafe died, his pediatrician was my pediatrician. She was the president of the Florida Academy of Pediatrics, and she blew our mind with what was behind the curtain. Thousands of kids lose their life every single year in America to detectable heart conditions. I'm a big believer in AEDs and CPR. I know what it's like to not have an AED and watch a friend die. I know what it's like to not know CPR. But I also know from the public health perspective, we haven't reduced sudden cardiac death in America by more than a percentage point or two in 50 years. Because what we're doing is not working. 4 million AEDs later, billions of dollars later, we've saved a lot of lives. But the denominator on how many kids and how many adults have died of sudden cardiac arrest is so great that we haven't even put a dent in it. In other countries, and I'm happy to debate this with anybody, like in Italy, it's been delivered every year since the 80s. Led by a man on our medical advisory team, Dr. Antonio Palicia. They've reduced cardiac death by 90% in student athletes. It's the culture. Every kid gets it. We sent Dr. Antonio Palicia, who's on the International Olympic Committee as the chair of the cardiovascular screening group, the study that came out, and he welcomes the opportunity to speak on any of these points, as do the regional experts at BayCare, All Children's, Arnold Palmer, Orlando Health, Advent Health, Nemours, Health First, Parish, and many more hospitals around the state of Florida that we work with. What makes this moment unique right now is that for the first time in the state of Florida, though this bill has been considered for 5 decades, there's 8 or 9 school districts who've required this. Kids get to grow up in these school districts. Hundreds of kids have been saved. And last October, Who We Play For presented before the American Academy of Pediatrics. And yes, every major medical group in America supports the idea of ECG screening. The debate is always, how do you do it for the most vulnerable kids? I would love to get in the nuance on how we're doing it in these districts, how every kid's getting follow-up care, cost-effective, whether they can afford the ECG or they have insurance or whatever it may be. And I leave you with a quote from the chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics, Pediatric Cardiology. He's the top pediatric cardiologist in America. And after our presentation last October, his quote is this. Let me get my notes going. All right, it's a little long. I'm going to try and paraphrase.
Mr. Ernst, I'm going to have to cut you off.
Okay.
We've only got like 2 minutes.
Yeah, no worries. Moral of the story, it can be done, and we should mandate and require this. Thank you.
Members and ladies and gentlemen, there's not a member on this panel that doesn't think that one life saved is not the right thing to do. But what we are required to do is make good, and if we're going to do this, we're required to make sure that we implement good public policy. Cost is not the only consideration here. It is about public policy. It's about making good public policy so that it can be implemented across the state of Florida in a manner that is equitable to every student, that's equitable to every parent. And so we have to make sure that we do that. I don't think any member up here is putting a decision based on this, on what we heard from OPAGA today. We asked them to do a report on what current findings, what they could find, those types of things. And so the report was given. And so I want to tell you all, I appreciate all of you coming here today. I appreciate you making the trip up here. Sean, thank you for all the Facebook messages that you send me. They're very informative. And we do have a bill that's been filed. We'll possibly hear it in this committee, but as you can see, there are a lot of questions, and I think the members actually were fairly, just because of time constraints, I think they understood that there's probably other questions, and certainly as we go further into this, we'll have more questions as we go along. Again, we appreciate all of you being here. Members, thank you for your attention today. Without further business, Ranking Member Bush makes a motion that we adjourn. Thank you.